Today on Maine Calling, sex education, then and now. The concept of sex ed goes back to the turn of the last century, when a group of doctors and social welfare advocates were trying to figure out a way to slow the spread of syphilis and gonorrhea. From the beginning, it was controversial and has remained a hot and polarizing issue in the decades since. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with a Maine author who has written a history of the topic. It is titled, The Fight for Sex Ed, the Century-Long Battle Between Truth and Doctrine. We'll also hear from a sex educator with Maine Family Planning. What should we be teaching young people? At what age? What works and what doesn't? Does talking about sex encourage it? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. What was sex ed like in your high school? Lots of snickering while the gym teacher did his or her best? A quick lesson as part of biology class? Or maybe sex ed didn't exist at all in your school? School districts have grappled with the best way to present sex ed for decades now. A new book by a Maine author looks at its evolution, and she joins us today. Margaret Grace Myers is the author of The Fight for Sex Ed, The Century-Long Battle Between Truth and Doctrine. And also with us to talk about what's going on in Maine schools today, Lynette Johnson, who is Maine Family Planning's Director of Prevention Programs and Prevention Education. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you think needs to be taught in the schools when it comes to sex ed? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Lynette, Margaret, welcome to both of you. And Margaret, congratulations on the book. We think of sex ed as a contemporary issue, but it really isn't, is it?
It's really not. I was completely surprised and shocked when I sort of came upon how early ideas of sex ed, which was not called sex ed, but how early those ideas were really in the American world, in the American context.
Your book takes us back to the beginning of the last century. We're talking right after 1900. What was going on back then that made a handful of people realize that some sort of sexual education might be necessary?
Yeah, so it was really interesting. And it was really this sort of dual concern about these extremely high rates of sexually transmitted infections. And just to give one statistic that I always find very enlightening is one doctor in Baltimore, I believe it was 1915, somewhere in that decade, estimated that in Baltimore, a full 70% of men had gonorrhea. And so that's a huge number and a public health concern. But it's as a public health concern, but also for a certain group of people, a real moral issue. There was an absolute rock solid belief that STIs came from sex work, what would have just been called was prostitution, referred to as prostitution. And so you had this very sort of unlikely alliance, well, from our perspective, perhaps seemingly unlikely alliance between medical doctors who really saw this as a public health crisis. And then you had these sort of Christian activists, many of whom were the same, you know, that was a group that had a big overlap in that Venn diagram there, but who really saw this as a moral crisis. And so one of the ways that they thought could be a way to decrease these number of STIs was to begin to educate people, including young people, about their bodies and the risk of sex.
All right. And so How was that taken when they started educating people?
Not very well. it's very interesting, and I know Lynette will be able to speak to this as well, but what really hooked me into writing this was that the arguments for and against sex ed have remained pretty much the same for the past 120 years, because just as quickly as doctors and activists were saying, well, should we teach young people about the risks of sex? You had this absolute immediate concern that that would lead to there being more sex, that this would lead to young people becoming quote unquote promiscuous. And so kind of all of these things that people might remember from their own lives, if they remember any sort of arguments or discussions about sex ed, those pretty much played out immediately as early as the first real example I talk about is 1913 in Chicago, where we're really seeing the same arguments that we see today over sex ed.
Yeah, and you're talking about Ella Flagg, right? She's a woman who created sex hygiene lectures, which are also referred to as purity lectures. And some people embraced her, but then others really fought back, right?
Absolutely. And and I think it's funny now, of course, because we hear the word personal purity, and it's so, you know, sort of now, of course, the opposite of what we might associate with sex ed. But yes, it was this amazing. She was the first female superintendent of any city schools. She was in Chicago, and she basically, Chicago had a vice commission, found this huge number of STIs, and they suggested in their commission work that some sort of sex education in schools might be valuable. She was able to sort of implement it, but the backlash she faced, I mean, it was months long, drawn out. Eventually the classes did begin, and these were sort of one-off lectures to first the parents, then later the students. But after, I believe it was only a semester, the outrage was so much that they ended. And so it was sort of a valiant first effort with mixed success.
Well, one of the many things I thought was so interesting in your book, Margaret, was the discussion of films. And we see films way back in World War I trying to encourage soldiers to, I think it was called Fit to Serve, right? And encourage soldiers,
fit to fight,
to abstain because of gonorrhea and syphilis. And I can't play a clip of that film because it is a silent film. I did find it, though. It's findable on YouTube. But then there is a film that came later that was very influential, and we can play a clip from that. This was the first sex ed film shown to really large audiences of students. It's from 1947, and the film was called Human Growth.
By the time they reach their late teens or early 20s, when they have completed their education, have a steady job, want to get married, and are ready to accept the responsibility of having and raising children, the differences in sexual maturity will have disappeared. Human growth can begin only when the sperm cells of the father, during mating, pass from the penis into the vagina of the mother. The sperm cells use their thread-like tails to move into the uterus and tubes. If the sperm cells meet an ovum, and one sperm succeeds in breaking through the cell wall, fertilization occurs.
Well, Margaret, two things stand out to me from that single clip, and that is just one little clip in the whole film. One, that sex was only put into the context of marriage, and two, my using the word sex, well, that word doesn't actually happen in
Correct.
This film. It was pretty much skipped over.
Yes, absolutely. And that film was used actually all the way until the early 70s. And I remember reading one critic in the 70s talking about, I think they phrased it so perfectly, said something about how it fails to relate how the penis might actually get those cells into the ovum. So, you know, you really do, you think of a young person and you think, okay, so somehow through mating, whatever that might mean, this happens, but there's no actual information about what that looks like, how it might happen. And of course, as you point out, it absolutely is only in the context of marriage. And that is really the fundamental kind of backbone of American sex ed has been for a long time, has been that sex only happens in marriage. And that's because we are have it's really been shaped by Christian understandings that sex should only happen within marriage. So you find yourself in kind of a trap if that's your way of thinking, because it means that if you do want to tell young people about sex, you have to kind of phrase it as, well, this is a thing that only happens in marriage. It's a pretty amazing, once you start to notice that framework, you really do see it everywhere.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that this film didn't actually help cut down on the rates of STIs or on teen pregnancy?
No, well, of course, what's also interesting is there's no information about that infections can happen or how you might prevent a pregnancy if you wanted to. It only tells you, you know, sort of in theory, in mating, after marriage, how this might happen. And so in terms of actionable education for young people, right, it really provides nothing in the way of advice. It is sort of a basic sort of biological explanation that, of course, does put it in context of, you know, I do think it's funny. It says, you know, first you get a job and you grow, you know, and then you get married and then this happens. But no, it doesn't do anything in terms of prevention.
All right. And I don't think I'm giving away the plot, Margaret, to say more and more chapters about how an idea is introduced. There's a new initiative. A new initiative happens because of a public health crisis, whether it's venereal disease, whether it's teen pregnancy, whether it's AIDS. You know, there's a big effort, sincere effort to try to cut down on this thing. And then there's a backlash. And the thing that has come into American life suddenly is squashed. And Lynette, I want to bring you into the conversation here. You know, these debates are still going on today, right? Like, what is appropriate to teach our kids? I understand, Margaret, you write about this in your book, but there remains no federal law about sex education. And in fact, a study just came out of Boston University saying only 37 states require sexual education to be medically accurate.
That's correct. And we have come a bit of a ways since that clip that we heard in terms of what's being taught in sex ed these days. But certainly every state can make their own laws and decide what they want to teach or what they want to avoid teaching or what they want to require schools teach or not teach. And that's the way it's been. And even in Maine, while we have a comprehensive approach to sex education, while we have standards from the Maine Department of Education for health education and sexual health education, it really depends. There's a lot of local control in different school districts. So what you might receive in one part of the state might be very different in another part of the state. So the standards are there. The resources are there. Maine Family Planning provides training. We write our own curriculum. We update that on a regular basis. We have a very strong relationship with the Department of Education in terms of collaborating. But what, in fact, a health teacher or a school district decides to teach or not teach is really up to local control.
And is there a great deal of variation throughout the state of Maine, Lynette?
Oh, there is. I think that some people might just be talking about STI prevention. You might have a health educator that really wasn't trained to be a health educator. It's someone in a school district that was assigned to teach health. And if they're not comfortable teaching it, they might really not teach anything. Or they might bring an outside speaker from the local, maybe domestic violence or sexual assault prevention center to provide information on healthy relationships. But if they're not comfortable, or if their administrator of their school has decided that they don't want to, you know, go there because they're afraid of pushback from parents or the community, they might not teach anything.
Margaret, I see you nodding. Where does Maine stand in terms of other states, in terms of what kind of sex education is provided and what kind of laws are on the books?
Yeah, I mean, I think both Lynette and I know that, you know, Maine compared to many other states has, as Lynette said, really strong written guidelines, really strong standards, but also, so in that way, very strong. It is that piece where you talk about what actually happens in schools where it gets a little dicier, but we are sort of unsurprisingly very lucky with our guidelines. And Lynette, you might have more information.
I definitely agree. I'm fortunate enough to attend national conferences, and it's very stark the differences between from state to state. I usually sit at a table of varying, sex educators that provide a varying degree of education on certain topics, and they are always amazed, like, you can do that? Like, you can actually show a condom in a class? You know, so there's definitely people who really have to watch every word. They have to talk about, they're still talking about abstinence only until marriage in some cases. They're really talking about the harms that birth control could, the symptoms that, or the harms of birth control versus the efficacy of birth control. So they really are restricted. And so I think in terms of, how we compare with other states, we're really fortunate to have a lot of support.
Lynette, why the pushback about birth control? Don't most states want to prevent teen pregnancy?
You would think, but you can definitely see teen pregnancy rates are much higher in states that don't have comprehensive sex ed. If they just have abstinence only, I think some people are still thinking that if you talk about it, kids will just go out and have sex. That seems to be, Margaret mentioned in her book that is debunked, that doesn't happen. In fact, the more education that young people have, the better choices they make, or not necessarily better, but healthier choices they make. And so sex education actually ends up having young people be able to talk about waiting to have sex and how to communicate with a partner and thinking about it ahead of time.
All right. Well, we are talking about the history of sex ed and where we stand today as a nation. What are your questions or comments for our guests? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning about sex ed, its history, and how it's taught in Maine. Joining me today, Margaret Grace Myers. She is an educator based in Maine and the author of the new book, The Fight for Sex Ed, The Century-Long Battle Between Truth and Doctrine. Also with us, Lynette Johnson, who is Director of Prevention Programs and Prevention Education for Maine Family Planning. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you wish you had learned when taking sex ed in high school? Who taught you what you know? Did you hear it from friends, parents, books, teachers? Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Margaret, I'm asking you if you would be willing to read a passage that really made me think, that's toward the end of your book. And it just sort of reflecting on this whole idea of sex ed in the schools. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Another question that often comes up to me, but also throughout the history of sex ed, is whether sex ed belongs in schools. I've kept myself out of this book for many reasons, but here, finally, in these last pages, I can tell you what I really think on that question and on others. Does sex ed, quote, belong in schools? Who knows? We humans invented schools. Nothing inherently belongs in them. We also invented sex ed and marriage and the concept of abstinence. The data firmly points to the fact that comprehensive sex ed is an effective tool for reducing STIs and rates of teen pregnancy. And for this reason alone, I posit that yes, it does belong in school.
So there you go. After all the research and knowing the whole history, but that is one of the critical questions, right? Even these public health advocates a century ago, they looked around and they thought, people need to know this. People need to know this when they're young. Where can we reach them all? We reach them all in the schools. I mean, it's really that basic, right?
And that's really it. And there's been some amazing, beautiful writing that I quote in the book, you know, that the public school, if you look at it in a certain way, is this amazing, really beautiful, really special opportunity to reach all, you know, in theory, all American children, all American young people. And when you have that kind of opportunity, why not include this kind of information, which clearly has really positive, and that is absolutely data-driven proof positive effects on our young people.
We'll go to Gabrielle, who's calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Gabrielle, go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. I have a couple thoughts I wanted to share. The first was, I grew up with a French mother who was all about talking about sex, and I was one of the few girls in my school who did not get pregnant in the 80s, so I felt like it's anecdotal but also kind of striking. Second thing is, I have a friend who teaches sex ed who started teaching it and was together with her recently, and she was asking, is there a place in sex ed to talk about women getting pregnant less easily the older they get so that they know that and can tuck that away for later? And then my third thing, take these in any order, is that there's a book called The Girls Who Went Away about the girls who got pregnant and got sent away back in, I think, the 60s. And one of the girls' stories that stuck with me was that she finds out she's pregnant and she says to her doctor, oh, no, my parents said I couldn't get pregnant until I was married. She thought it was a preventative because she had such little information. So there you have it.
Yeah. Well, I'll turn to you first, Lynette, about Gabrielle's question about someone. The whole thinking about not just how to get pregnant, how to prevent STIs, but then also what she said about how your chances of getting pregnant, how your body changes as you age. Lynette, is that part of what's being taught today?
I would say in part, we definitely talk to young people about sexual health throughout their lifespan. We don't spend a lot of time in the older ages, but we do talk about the importance of keeping track of your sexual health, seeing a doctor regularly, talking to them about, you know, what you might need to prevent pregnancy. A lot of people come to our clinics to find out, like, I haven't been able to get pregnant, you know, what should I do? So I think that mostly in high school, the high school level, we don't necessarily jump forward to like, oh, you better hurry up now because, you know, your eggs are only going to be so good. I mean, we can talk about the ovaries and the eggs, and a person is born with all of the eggs that they'll have. And over time they, you know, we can talk about that, but we don't necessarily go into like a later stages of life. We have a new curriculum that we're working on our curriculum. We're updating it. And one of the sections is about through the lifetime, you know, what things you should be taking, you know, keeping track of. And that includes cancer screenings and, you know, menopause and things like that. But in general, we talk about that and the importance of continually, you know, seeking out sexual health care throughout your lifetime.
And Margaret, I want to turn to you about something else Gabrielle said, that she knows someone who didn't think you could get pregnant unless you were married. And somebody might snicker at that, but if you don't know, you don't know, right?
Well, and that's exactly it. I mean, and that's kind of an amazing story. And I think it also goes to show, you know, young people, and obviously as that person was old enough to you know, become pregnant, but I teach little kids in my day job, and I always have to remind myself, you know, right, we only know what we know. And so when a person is given the instruction, you know, you can't have kids until you get married, you know, that taken on its face, sounds like it could sound exactly like you cannot physically have kids until you are married. It makes perfect sense in one very skewed understanding. And that's what I mean when I say, you know, that this, you know, which I say throughout the book, you know, abstinence really has a hold on our country still and how we think about sex in a way that is really destructive.
Gabrielle, thanks so much for your call. We're going to turn to Nisha Savov. Nisha, how do I pronounce your last name?
Savov.
Okay, great. I'm so glad you called in. Now, you're in high school now, and I'm going to take me back to my high school. It was sex ed was very brief. It was taught by the gym teacher. I think he was doing his best, but it was anything but comprehensive. What do you have today in your high school?
So the way sex education looks at my high school is that it's part of like a broader health class curriculum that kind of touches on like a lot of subjects like mental health, substance abuse, just like, I guess, general, like basic biology. So our sex education is still kind of brief. I'd say it's like a unit that lasts maybe like 2-3 weeks maybe.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel as though it's effective, that you're learning what you need to learn?
Yeah, I think in many ways it's a lot better than like the old fashioned sex education that used to exist and maybe still does in some parts of the country. But a majority of our sex education is focused on, I guess, like prevention of like unwanted pregnancies or like STIs or something like that. So in that, I guess in that respect, it's like still a little bit old fashioned.
Mm. And Nisha, one thing I wanted to ask you is if you've heard the show up to this point, one of the arguments against sex education throughout history has been, if we teach young people about sex, they're going to have more sex. And instead of abstaining, do you think that's true?
I don't really know. I think that, to be completely honest, I don't think it really has any effect. I mean, I wouldn't really. Yeah, I don't think it has very much effect. I don't think people really care too much about the sex education curriculum or the health curriculum in general. But I think that just having that information is helpful.
Yeah, before I say goodbye to you, I'm going to give a chance for my guests to ask you a question if they want to. Margaret is the author of the book we're talking about. Margaret, do you have a question for Nisha?
Not really. I thank so much for your time. You know, this is, it's always so good to hear what's going on the ground. And I think you're right that actually the data also tends to show that sex ed classes and sort of all classes have very little sway over behavior. It gives you the information you need, but it's hard to control anyone's behavior. I don't think you're wrong on you know, whether or not sex ed has anything to do with what young people do with their bodies, other than possibly giving them the information they need about preventing pregnancy or STIs.
And Lynette, do you have a question for Nisha?
Not necessarily a question, but I do think that we're trying to get away from just like, here's the facts about birth control, here's the facts about STIs, because there are so many wonderful resources out there to get that information. And oftentimes young people, you know, if they're not needing it right now, is just kind of maybe going over their head. They might have this, you know, small nugget in their brain that they can remember for the time when it's going to be useful and relevant to them. So we've really been trying to get away from that and like have more general conversations around healthy relationships and consent, and you know, how you can talk to a partner about birth control if you want to go on birth control. So I'm hoping it's really helpful to know that that's what you felt like most of your education was, because we're really trying to move beyond just the facts and try to get into the attitudes and discussion among students about what feels respectful in a relationship and things like that.
Nisha, before I let you go, I need to ask you, how did the students take it? Is this something, it sounds like you feel like it's kind of no big deal.
Well, it is a required credit. So I think with any sort of class that you're kind of forced to take, there's not a lot of enthusiasm. So yeah, I guess in that way, it's not something that really interests many people. But it's a pass fail. So you kind of just have to put in like enough effort and like learn enough that you can kind of get by. And I think that, I mean, there's value to that too. I feel like just in general, there's some conversations that are always like uncomfortable or like not necessarily preferable to be having, but you kind of need to have them anyways. So I think in that way, it's like structured appropriately.
Well, Nisha, thanks so much for calling in. So important to have your perspective here on Maine Calling today. Nisha is a high school student in Portland. We're going to go also to Portland and Michael. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question. It's my understanding that the book, It's Perfectly Normal, has been like a super controversial book and it's been banned from a lot of libraries. I was in a Goodwill and I found a copy and I read it. And I'm a pretty liberal person, but I was surprised what was in there. It was pretty graphic, but I'm not a professional, so I didn't really know what to think about it. So I'm curious what professionals think about this book.
Yeah, Michael, thanks so much for calling in. And Margaret, the book he's talking about is called It's Perfectly Normal, and it's one of the books that's being banned around the country. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so It's Perfectly Normal has been sort of a recent, I would say kind of a modern classic, contemporary classic for what we consider sort of good sex ed for kids. I'm just reminding myself what age group it's recommended for. It's funny because, you know, it was in a Goodwill. So it's like, it has been updated, but it is a children's book. You know, I think the thing that, you know, people often are surprised by what young people are ready to learn about. And Lynette, you might be able to speak on that a little bit more, teaching contemporary or, you know, knowing about contemporary. But, you know, I think the big thing with kids, with young people too, and this is really for children. I believe it's middle school level or actually maybe even elementary. The thing I always keep in mind is if they're old enough to ask, they're old enough to know. And kids have a lot of questions starting very, very early. And so it makes sense that this has been banned, but I think we mostly regard it as a good text.
Lynette?
Yeah, I would add that it is a great resource and we have it on our list for parents. It's a great conversation between parents and kids. And it's mostly like older elementary through like middle school. So it really covers changing bodies, like going through puberty and what to expect. But it also talks about how someone gets pregnant and it shows, you know, a pregnant body. And, you know, so there's definitely things that are probably much more appropriate between a parent or guardian and children at home having those discussions. I don't think I know of any educators at that level that are actually using that book in a classroom, but it might be in a library that's been banned. But it's just a wonderful resource if parents want to have those discussions with their kids.
Michael, thank you for that question. A Facebook comment from Jen: I have always assumed that school was the best place for sex ed because teachers would have access to the best and most recent information on topics like emergent STIs and birth control methods. The stuff I learned decades ago would be outdated for today's kids, I would think. Am I giving the curriculum too much credit? Lynette?
I think that if a health educator has done some training, they are going to be probably the most reliable source for a student in school, aside from a school nurse. I mean, school nurses as well are great resources for students, but they are going to if they keep up on it, if they're, you know, using some of our resources, some of the websites we recommend, they're going to have the most up-to-date information. And it's very interesting thinking about where should sex ed be taught. And, you know, over history, it really struck me in your book, Margaret, how the fight for sex ed was like, no, in the home, no, in schools. But it should be not one or the other, this or that. It should be like all of the above, right? So in the home, in schools, in the community, we have some community-based education programs that are taught by trusted adults in youth-serving organizations that are also, you know, teaching this information. So guardians, parents, they might not have all the information. In fact, I've done parent education classes where at the end, you know, the parent comes up and like, oh, can you tell me a little bit more about that? I had no idea that that's how blank, 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 blank. So, you know, I think parents teach values, parents teach, you know, the religious cultural context that they're, you know, that they are they're raising their children in. But, you know, there are some really helpful, if the teacher's trained, you know, if they have the most up-to-date information, that is a good source.
Margaret.
Yeah, and Lynette, I think I totally agree with everything you say. And as you were saying at the end there, you know, that information piece for really what is the older end of the student population, yes, that absolutely is sort of best served by people who are the most up to date. But sex ed begins at birth, and it is a conversation that should be happening. I mean, when we talk about should, ideally, you know, parents and trusted caregivers are talking to the young people, the children in their lives, about sex and sexuality, consent, safe touch, strangers, body parts from day one, you know. And so often people have thought of sex ed as either one conversation or one class. And really, ideally, it is, as Lynette says, this holistic thing that starts from the beginning and goes forever, because we're always learning. And those very practical little pieces of information are key, but they're really a very small portion of what should, quote unquote, be sex ed.
We'll go to Bob, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hey there. Wonderful program. Thank you. I'm a physician assistant, and just wanted to share a little story. I was the oldest child of five, raised Catholic, a lot of energies around sexuality. And my dad, you know, had that wonderful opportunity to break out in sweat when he drove me in around in the car to tell me about sex. But my mother, prior to that, had given me a book, the first chapter, which, referring back to some of what was said early on, the first chapter, which is about the egg and the sperm and the so forth. And the third chapter was about having a baby. And the second chapter she ripped out of the book. So I had some little distortion there about missing out on some of that. There was some interesting information in my sex ed class, but it, you know, I got over all of that missing chapter over my life, including professionally, and I'm now a certified sex addiction therapist. So I have other distortions to deal with in that regard professionally, but just wanted to share that.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for recounting that story. I'm sure many of our audience members are chuckling right now. We do need to take another quick break. If you'd like to join this conversation about sex ed in America or in Maine, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today we are discussing how sex ed has been taught historically, how that's evolved over the years. With me, Maine Family Planning's Lynette Johnson and Margaret Grace Myers, who is author of the book, The Fight for Sex Ed. Share your comments and questions. Send us a brief email, if you're quick, to talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. A couple weeks ago, we put the question in our Maine Calling newsletter, what was sex ed like for you growing up? And I'm going to read parts of a few answers here. From Cheryl, we had an email. My home ec phys ed teacher was progressive for her time. She'd gone back to college when she was in her late 30s, and I believe especially because she had daughters, she wanted to see girls better prepared. However, rules are always the rules, and the most she could teach us was the parts of the female anatomy, and that was a big deal. An email from Beth. I grew up in South Carolina. There was absolutely no sex education. I blame it on the religious world there. My mother was an obstetrics nurse, so it's surprising she never mentioned it. However, my father had died and she had to work full time. She had four children. I guess she was doing the best she could. When I started my period, I had no idea what was happening. Perhaps if I'd known something about sex, I could have avoided being raped by a classmate in high school. Again, I had no idea what was happening. It was years later at age 49 when my psychiatrist told me I'd probably been drugged with the date rape drug. Also, when I was going through menopause, hot flashes, and depression, no one, not even my primary physician, mentioned the word menopause. So she says, sex education also might have helped my sex life throughout marriage. And Wynn writes, as a member of the high school class of 1967, the word sex was not mentioned, educationally or otherwise. What might we have learned? Too far from reality to consider such a topic. So, Margaret, hearing those clearly from people who are, who came of age in the years that your book writes about, no surprise, right?
No surprise. And I think it just, you know, clearly these people are all living and hopefully, you know, full lives, but it makes me, you know, sad to think how much, you know, when somebody gets their period and doesn't know what's going on, I mean, that could be saved by, you know, a single conversation, you know, still not necessarily, you know, still going to be something new and potentially scary and all of those things, but to be completely surprised and not know what your body is doing. And that's, I think about that a lot. You know, there's nothing wrong with having a body. And I think that a lot of what I have been hearing and seeing and reading, you know, there's so much shame around sex and anything that has to do with sex that, you know, these completely natural processes are just avoided and ignored in school, at home, at the doctor, you know, and these are just our bodies. So it really, it makes me sad.
We'll go to Brian calling from Belfast. Hi, Brian, go ahead.
Hi, I don't think we've got this figured out yet. 45 million Americans have HPV, and it's estimated that 85% of the population will in their lifetime. We still have 1 million abortions a year. Sounds a lot like 1918. So if the goal is to reduce unwanted pregnancy and disease, it doesn't seem like we're accomplishing that. That's just one example. What do we have to do to figure out what's actually going to work?
Good question. Lynette, thoughts?
I think we need more people speaking out. I feel the empowerment of young people today is very hopeful. I think they are demanding more information, and I'm not sure, you know, how that looks in different schools, but they are seeking out information, and that's one of the challenges today is how to make sure they're finding helpful information and not harmful information, because the World Wide Web has just made sex ed a completely different, you know, thing in the world. And some of the information that's out there is very harmful, but young people are really advocating for themselves. I know a lot more than when I was in sex education in school. And it gives me hope that that they will be advocating for themselves more, hopefully. And I don't know, eventually that might bring change.
Brian, thank you for your question. We'll go to Freeport and Biz. Hi, Biz, go ahead.
Good morning. First of all, full disclosure, I want to tell you how proud I am of Margaret for writing this book. She's my niece. And hi to Jen. You've more or less answered my question just by listening. It's such an informative show. But I remember learning years ago that the best time to teach sex ed and to teach about the body parts that are involved in making a baby is when you're 2 or 3 years old, and if that child is curious and willing to hear it. Because then when they get to the middle school and they hear, you know, the potty talk, they already have heard those words. They know what it means. It's just a natural part of their existence as humans. I wonder if that, it sounds like it is a continuum, as Margaret said, but I was wondering if there's, and obviously that would have to be taught at home. Is there still evidence that that's true?
Lynette?
Yes, I think the earlier we start talking to our children about sexual health, the better. And when we use the sexual health, people's minds generally go to like, oh, they're sharing condoms in kindergarten. You know, it's all age appropriate. And so a 2-year-old, you can start by teaching them consent. Can I touch your body? Or, you know, just introducing some of those concepts around consent, or having boundaries, or how to self-regulate. And then you can talk about their body parts, which is so, so important for kids to know the correct names of their body parts. And then like who, you know, if someone touches you here, that's not okay. When is it okay to do this privately or publicly? You know, having those conversations when they're very, very young, and then moving into like when their bodies start to change and grow, hopefully they're getting puberty education in school, but we're also reinforcing when you're with your friends. You know, what do you want in a healthy friendship? And how can you tell a friend that, you know, that you hurt their, they hurt your feelings? And what should you do if you hurt somebody else's feelings? So we're talking about relationships, we're talking about body changes, how emotions and hormones can really change how you react. And then that just builds on each other as they get older and they start to learn more complicated information about sexual health. But 2 years, you know, 2 years old is a good time to start talking about bodies and, you know, having body autonomy and all of that.
Lynette, where can a parent or a grandparent turn for some help with those conversations? Are there resources out there?
There are. There's some great websites. There's a website called amaze.org. It's a little bit older. I think they have a younger age group too. They have little videos. It's amaze.org. And they have lots of different short videos. They're mostly animated, and it talks about a whole range of, you know, sexual health, you know, information that is super age appropriate, from little kids on up through like maybe middle school.
All right. Biz, thanks so much for calling in. We'll go up to Brunswick and Tyler. Hi, Tyler. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you for having me. I just wanted to talk about, I took sex ed. I was in sex ed in 7th and 8th grade and 10th grade. And I believe that there's a lot of aspects of sex ed that is not taught properly at least in the curriculum that I was in. I was in the, Brunswick Junior High School, Brunswick High School, from 6th grade to 12th grade. And one thing that I feel like was never really mentioned to me and something I had to find out on my own thanks to the internet was woman's ovulation cycle. Like, I didn't realize that women couldn't get pregnant unless they were basically had an egg. And for the majority of the cycle, a woman is not able to get pregnant. That was something I had to look up online because, you know, I guess I was always under the impression that a woman could always get pregnant if you had unprotected sex. So,
Tyler, let me ask you a question. When you were in high school and middle school, were the boys and girls separated and the boys taught one thing and the girls taught something else?
No. We, from what I can recall, we were always in co-ed, sex ed. And I guess it wasn't called sex ed. I guess it was called health class. So that distinction.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for calling in. And while you were talking, Margaret was nodding. You've heard this story before, it sounds like, Margaret.
Well, just a lot of stories like it, you know, just that there is, well, there are so many ways. I wasn't sure how that story would end of, you know, sex ed not being taught the right way. There, as we all know, I think Lynette would agree, you know, some major gaps in how we teach certain things. And this example just seems like one of many major ways to improve it. And it's always good to know where those things are.
All right. Tyler, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to go to Gavin calling from Lyman. Hi, Gavin. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm just calling really to try to share concisely that I think sexual education is a very important thing. And someone said earlier on the show that it should be a holistic practice that is constantly unfolding. And I really agree with that point. I think young people are really smart. They're a lot smarter than we give them credit for. And we need to make this information widely accessible to them from the age that it's applicable. Because young people, you know, if we make the language around sex restrictive, safe sex will ultimately be harder for these young people to have. And I think a very dangerous thing, especially with people my age. I am 28 years old, and I was very sexually aware from a young age, like as early as 10 years old. And with the internet being accessible to my generation, you know, internet pornography was a big informant for me as to what I thought sex should be. And that is not generally a good modeling of roles for what healthy sex should look like. So I think that, you know, parents and educators definitely should be the primary source of information about sexual health and sexual well-being for young people. And we shouldn't do anything to kind of make the language restrictive or make the information.
Yeah, Gavin, I think you're making a really important point, and it's right at the end of the show. So, Lynette, we'd only have a little bit of time to respond, but Gavin has brought up the point of something that was not available for many of the years when you were writing your book, Margaret, but today, internet pornography and its influence on children.
I was going to just say thank you for bringing that up, because when we don't provide information throughout a young person's life, they have questions and they will find answers. They will look for answers, and who knows what those answers are going to be. And pornography, sexually explicit videos, I mean, it's so accessible for young people, and they certainly know how to get around adult supervision. So something to think about.
Well, Gavin, thank you so much for calling in, and you will be the last call today. And thank you both for joining us today. The voice you just heard, Lynette Johnson with Maine Family Planning. She's the Director of Prevention Programs and Prevention Education. And Margaret Grace Myers is the author of The Fight for Sex Ed, The Century-Long Battle Between Truth and Doctrine. Today's sound engineer was Chris Bridges. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.